end, but maybe we'll just go ahead and get started. And I realized as I was planning to do this session that there's something sort of deeply ironic about this, that I live in Iowa. And to talk about wilderness when you live in Iowa is it's kind of problematic. We don't have any wilderness in Iowa.
Minnesotans regard Iowa as wilderness.
I thought you regarded it as sort of alien or another.
That too, yeah.
And Iowa, depending on your how you judge this, Iowa is by some standards the most altered state in the United States. I mean, we tend to think of eastern states like New Jersey or New York as being more so, but those places actually have significant areas, New York in particular, if you've never been up into the Adirondacks, absolutely amazing place up there. But even New Jersey, the Pine Barrens region of southern New Jersey, has a tremendous sort of wild character to it. Whereas there is almost nowhere in the state of Iowa that has not been significantly altered by human beings. And the statistic that I sometimes think defines the state of Iowa more than any other is that when we're going to talk a lot about public lands today. The state of Iowa has more public lands in its roadways than it does in all of its parks, preserves, etc. put together. So it is a place that is in some ways the antithesis of wilderness. And I want to return at the very end today to talk about, after going through a series of questions, to ask, do we need more wilderness? And if so, where should we have it? And should we have more wilderness in the Midwest? Because some of you, but certainly not all of you, are in the Midwest. But I grew up as a kid in Iowa and couldn't wait to get out of there, like lots of kids in small towns, although had sort of my wild areas that I like to play in. And then it sort of sometimes feels strange that I found myself back in Iowa again. But my experience with wilderness is in a variety of places, but primarily in the North Woods of northern Minnesota and taking long canoe trips in Canada, including a long canoe trip to Hudson Bay many years ago. And then I went to graduate school in Colorado and spent lots of time in the wilderness there. And I want to talk today about it, sort of wilderness as, as a philosophical issue, but also as a land management type issue as well. And what I'd like to do as a starting point, I don't want to do introductions all the way around, but I would like you to find yourself. We'll do some stuff as a full group in terms of discussion, some stuff I want to talk through, but some I want you to talk through some different pieces. So if you can do it with a partner where you are or a couple, three people around where you are, I'd like you to find yourself at least a small discussion group that you can probably four or five times in the next hour take a couple of minutes to talk through different questions that I'm going to give you. But I want you to start by way of introducing yourself with that group of people to talk just a little bit about your personal experiences with wilderness. Did you grow up on the edge of a wilderness area? Did you, like me, grow up in a heavily agricultural area where there wasn't a lot of sort of wild land from there? Have you traveled extensively in the wilderness? I know from an earlier conversation today, we've got somebody here who's been on Everest expeditions and been into and done wilderness medicine. I suspect that there's a whole wide range of our own personal experiences. But just take a minute or two each with a group of two or three people to introduce yourself if need be, and to say, here's where I come from in terms of my relationship with wilderness. So you may need to move your chairs around just a little bit, and then we'll jump into things.
You are.
We're on the righteous side.
I was almost Iowa. My dad's land went right up to the land, to the Iowa border, across from Minnesota. It's 15 miles north of the wilderness.
So you know that story already.
My sister still lives
there. Okay. Are you a farmer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in the farm. You actually need to be born in the U.S. North. St. Paul there, you know, right on 35, right? What is that? So, yeah, my brother just sold it a couple of years ago. He kept 40 acres of corn, but I, the old farm was a golf course. Well, we got to pay to walk around there. And so I guess the only thing, you know, for the older district, it's going to northern Minnesota. Or something. Yeah, I think I can do a little bit up there. That's all I have. Yep. Yeah. North of Mille Lacs.
You can come back to them, but if you are, I want to focus you on a different question here for just a minute at the beginning that hopefully we'll return to again, which is how important is wilderness to Holden Village? I've been thinking about this since attending the information meeting about mine remediation last night when they said that one of the ideas they've talked about is taking Holden on the road during the time of the mine remediation. And it got me thinking about how important is the experience of Holden Village? How essential is wilderness to that? Let me set this up for just a minute. I think about Holden and the experiences that are there. I'm not a mathematician, but what is it about Holden? It's community, plus worship, plus study, or whether it's formal or just conversations that define the place. Plus other things that sort of fit in there depending on how it is. To some extent, there's a piece that has to do with recreation and retreat. And somewhere in that equation, the fact that we are in or on the edge of a wilderness sort of fits in there. I'd like you to sort of transition your conversation in for you in deciding to come here, for your experience here, how important do you think wilderness or this place is to that, this physical place?
I don't want to get picky, but just what do you mean with the word wilderness?
I'm going to ask you that in about 2.5 minutes.
I wasn't tracking with you.
No, here, I actually want you just to sort of think about the physical location of Holden Village as a place in the wilderness, as the part of the rhetoric anyway that comes out of it from there. So this physical location, if it's easier, think about it. I was trying to think about where might you go. Take a spot in Minnesota. There's a wonderful environmental learning center in southeastern Minnesota that could probably accommodate this many people. You could provide the same food. You could have the same sort of worship experiences. You could have most of the things that are here except if you stepped out of, if you, by the time you hiked a quarter of a mile, you'd be in a cornfield instead of being on the edge of a mountain from there. How important is the physical location in this remote place to your experience at Holton Village? Let's just take a couple of minutes and talk about it, and I want you to think about it again after we've talked about what do we really mean by wilderness, but I want that as part of a sort of initial starting point in your conversation.
To me, it's of characteristics of wilderness, or a definition, or sort of character, or sort of central elements. What are we talking about?
Disconnectedness.
Disconnectedness.
So there's a sense of being set apart from everyday life, or like cell phones, and I mean, set apart from.
Isolated. Isolation, shall we say?
So you're not connected in the same way.
In an environmental anthropology class I took in school, wilderness was defined something like a construct developed by city dwellers, because people who don't live in the city don't define it as wilderness. It's just where they live.
So there is this whole, there's a whole academic literature about wilderness as a social construction. And in many cases, a social construction of upper middle class white folks in the developed world.
And protection is only important to them because other people see the resources as a need to survive.
So it is, in that sense, it's a cultural construct. But say more about what even if it's a cultural construct, what do we, what is it? What defines that?
The word wild is in there.
Uh-huh.
So that's opposite of controlled or
developed.
Safe or
uh-huh.
secure. So,
so it's uncontrolled.
If you break down that word, maybe that's...
It's a place that is wild.
Yeah.
A wild ecosystem. Unmanaged. Although it has to, I don't know, it has to be managed these days or you don't have it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I think that was kind of what I, true wilderness to me is unmanaged. It's the way that the ecosystems just work together without much contamination by mankind.
So there is this notion of kind of at least limited human control, is that right?
Yeah.
Interference.
Uh-huh. And impact, because
impact.
There are wilderness areas, I think, that are receiving enough impact that in some people's definition of wilderness, it may not be wilderness anymore because it's too accessible almost.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of an elitist attitude, but I think that's at least within the concept.
I think that, especially from a human perspective, there's also this sense of making do, and so that it's a, kind of relates to the disconnectedness, but you're not able to, if you don't have something, you have to find a way to either make it or do something else that will suffice, and so it's this kind of sense of do what you can with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Which then I think leads to a greater sense of simplicity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for us, when we're there, we have to make do. Yeah, there's in some ways a forced simplicity involved because we don't have the same. Seems like the
kind of people have to come understand. We have friends in Colorado who built their home up into the mountains, fairly fancy, exclusive homes.
Mm-hmm.
They think they're in the wilderness, yet. It's something they resent when the bear comes in their backyard and chews up all their plants.
Mm-hmm.
Who was there first? I mean,
Well, that is, although where they are is actually Colorado Springs. It's not exactly.
It was once upon a time.
But a bear does show up occasionally.
Yeah, and there's all these tensions, between humans and nature, I think, that come out whenever we're talking about it. We want the security, but we want to feel like we're in a wild place.
Thank you.
Well, I was just going to ask, because literature and stuff, but I think about it in terms of the Bible too, right? And Jesus going into the wilderness, and I think of John the Baptist in the wilderness too. But I don't know the word that's being used there, and if it has the same. But does anybody else know when it's used in the Bible?
I don't know what it's.
Well, in the Bible, the wilderness is always the place where God takes his people to bring him back. And so the children of Israel, in order, in more or less, to be re-authenticated as God's people, are led into the wilderness. That's where purification takes place.
And
it's also the opposite,
right?
Of the corruption that occurs in a settled agricultural society. And so that's why Jesus goes into the wilderness. The prophets very often go into the wilderness,
mm-hmm.
and then come back. It's out in the wilderness that you finally become in contact with truth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think of it almost more as a, I mean, not always, but in a biblical way, it feels almost like a state of mind and a place where you can go for reflection or to be away or to be where things feel more raw and true and open at some level.
It's what the ritual studies people call liminality.
Well, that's what I'm just wondering. I'm just
so could it be a state of mind? Is that what you're?
Well, I'm
if
just thinking.
If it's a state of mind, you wouldn't have to go anywhere. I mean, if you could meditate and be there.
Right. No. I'm not saying it's just that, but I'm saying like, I think it also has Christian ramifications, right? So I think saying the word wilderness to somebody who's a Christian versus a non-Christian would be slightly different, because I think we do carry with us these other layers of what it is other than just the place where you go. It's also the mindset that you go into that place with and what might happen there is not just related maybe to nature, but related to what you're saying, what happens biblically when people go into this place.
What about the Buddhists? What about when they meditate and they go to that state of mind? They're not Christian.
Right, I'm not, I'm saying that I think it's both a physical place and a
right.
mental one.
It could not just to be recognized by Christians, that one.
Or perceived.
Well, I don't know how Buddhists would perceive this word, if wilderness would bring up for them a state of mind as well, and maybe it wouldn't. I'm not trying to make a judgment about what the word would bring up for them. I'm just saying because the Bible uses this word in a certain way, that I think people familiar with those stories, that there are other layers to it other than just this physical place.
And there's I was going to say a wonderful book, I don't know if I'd call it a wonderful book, a really interesting... although sort of dense book in some ways, by Roderick Nash, called The Idea of Wilderness, where he traces that biblical history and the sort of history of the concept. And it is in some ways a Western, it has a very strong sort of ties within the Judeo-Christian tradition as a result of that. And plays a central role, but it is, at least as I understand it, is in the biblical setting, always a physical place as well.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I think wilderness is defined in the Bible by its opposite. So it's the opposite of civilization.
Yeah.
It is the place that is apart, that is sort of set apart from there. But it's also, in the biblical sense, and I think in other places, it is a hostile place in some ways.
It's chaos versus cosmos.
That's right, right. And so there is this... And I do think this carrying through a lot of these ideas that we put up here and going back to that biblical history, there is this sense that wilderness is fundamentally defined by the absence of humans. Not totally, but it is the place that is not ordered for humans and is chaotic in that sense. And it is a place that we can go, that Jesus can go for 40 days, but it's not a place to make your home. It's a place that is sort of set apart from it in that way.
Because it was desert, right? When the 40 days in the desert, mm-hmm. and Jesus and the mm-hmm. wandering for 40 years in the desert.
Mm-hmm. And there is a sense, I think, that similar ideas, although not often called wilderness, are important in other religious traditions. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of American Indians mm-hmm. and vision quests where you sort of go away from the more settled, familiar, comfortable area for a period of time, and it is partly achieving a state of mind. And I want to return to this question of whether we need those physical places that are totally set apart and are wild in that way. Yeah.
Maybe you could say it's where you go to find yourself as well as God.
Certainly there's a long tradition of people going into the wilderness to find themselves. And I don't know if that's, I want to come back to whether that is the primary purpose or primary end, but that is a, has been a piece of it in the past. I mean,
simplistically, growing up on a farm in Minnesota, the wilderness to me was going to northern Minnesota or into Canada where it was all woods, you got trees and all that, to find it at that time, just thinking of it that way.
Part of what I want to do is then to say all of these things, which I think get us very close to what we mean when we use the word wilderness, are tied up into an important distinction that I think we need to make. And the way that I tend to think of it is there's a difference between wilderness as a description of, in some ways that's a subjective experience that you can have in different areas, versus wilderness as what I think of it these days as a prescription. But as a specific land management classification. And so we are, in some sense, at Holden Village in the wilderness. But if you start walking the trail out that way, you go out that way, and in 10 minutes you come across a sign, and what does it say? You're entering the wilderness. And I've known people that come here before, it's like, wait a minute, I thought I was already in the wilderness. What's the difference when all of a sudden I step over that sign, step past there, I've crossed a boundary on a map somewhere, but that boundary is incredibly significant within the United States as a federally protected wilderness area. And what I'd like to do is shift the conversation a little bit in the direction of talking about wilderness areas and then sort of cycle ourselves back around to talking about the concept of wilderness a little bit there as well. And so just a little bit of history, I think, without going too far. Some of you probably know this better than I do, so jump in if you will. But I wanted to just provide a little bit of that context as we think about it. I have been reading to my kids the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, which is wonderful. I never read them as a kid. But it's fun to be thinking again about the frontier. And arguably, the frontier is one of the defining features of the United States. And people kept moving further west and sort of heading out into wilder areas and looking for greener pastures. As people moved further and further west, there was the Homestead Act, and people could get their claims if they lived there and they improved the land, if you will. But as more and more people moved west, there was a sense among the leaders in the United States that, wait a minute, we didn't want to give all this land away. We should hang on to some of it. So in the late 19th century and early 20th century, there was a movement to really create public lands. So instead of all of that land sort of being made available to private homeowners, to railroads, the state of Washington has a lot of land, like other states, that was given to railroads. And there's still a lot of that in places that is owned by the railroads or owned by private areas. There was a lot of it that was put into public lands. And particularly around the turn of the 20th century, there was this sort of national discussion about what should we do with these public lands. And in some ways that discussion continues today and probably will keep continuing for another 100 years or so.
And that was a huge historic moment, because in the past, in Europe and you know, from the tradition that most of us come from, Judeo-Christian, the only large tracts of land were privately held. They were held by the noblemen and the rich, you know, the people that had the assets. And so for a country to set aside land, like with the national park, and then make it available for all citizens and say, hey, you know, in some sense you own it, was a totally new construct in society.
It was also serendipitous in a lot of ways, because Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, very rich men, had that ethic, and not many others did.
That's right.
And they did it sort of politically in backdoor deals.
Right, and not sure if you put it to a national referendum that people would have been in favor of sort of forming the United States Forest Service as they did in the first decade of the 20th century from there. And so you have these huge amounts of land, but it tends to be concentrated in the West in particular, and I would say sort of in the Intermountain West. So states like Iowa that sort of got swept across by that range of the frontier from there. In a sense, all the land was gone before they said, hey, let's create some public lands. And it's also because it was richer farmland at that time. But then you have many of these western states where you have very large tracts of public land. Where I used to live in Colorado, it was almost 50-50 in the state of Colorado, 50% public land, 50% private land. The state of Nevada is over 90% of all of the land in the state of Nevada is public land. Most of that is federal public land, but there's a good chunk of it that is in different organizations from there. Utah is maybe 75% public land. I should have looked it up. I don't know what Washington is. Does anybody have any idea?
Oregon is a high percentage, but I'm not sure what it is.
I'm guessing, just from the little bit that I've sort of looked at maps and looking at national forests, etc., that the state of Washington is somewhere
60,
in that,
40 or something.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it'd be in that half and half from there. And what does that look like? I'm going to get rid of some of this. I mean, there are lots of different organizations, different sort of arms of the government that own land. And the one that owns a tremendous amount of land that people don't often know about is the Department of Defense. I mean, there's huge sort of defense missile ranges and other sorts of things, and they don't like all that often to put them on maps sometimes, and so we don't think about it. From the point of view of wilderness, and we'll sort of push the story forward, there are four agencies that are most important. First of all is the National Park Service, in many ways the oldest of those public lands agencies. That our national parks were set aside primarily, I think, from the beginning for the idea of tourism, to sort of preserve those areas so people can come and see them. The U.S. Forest Service As we said before, Gifford Pinchot was really the founder of the U.S. Forest Service going back, and we have these large tracts of forest. The U.S. Forest Service, I think, it's important to keep in mind, is a part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And unlike other organizations, there is very much of a sort of production mindset that's there, and from the very beginning, for timber, and to some extent for mining, although not as much so, were absolutely central pieces of that vision. Gifford Pinchot was a progressive. He was a utilitarian. He was interested in preserving these areas, but preserving them for the long-term use of those natural resources that were there. The Bureau of Land Management, originally called the Grazing Service, for those of you who have been into areas that tend to be drier, in Utah and areas in eastern Washington and other places, oftentimes it's still used very much for grazing. Environmentalists like to call it the Bureau of Livestock and Mining, and it has, from the very beginning, grazing, livestock, and minerals, and increasingly oil and gas production are very central pieces of what happens on BLM land. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which, I mean, the idea there is to protect biodiversity. And not as many wilderness areas there, but these four agencies control hundreds of millions of acres of land in the United States for different reasons, but all of them were tied up from early on in discussions around wilderness. So these public lands, really through the teens and 20s and 30s, most of this land was designated in this way, and ongoing discussions about how does it get used. As early as the 1920s, there are strong voices stepping forward to say, hey, yeah, it's important that we have logs, that we have lumber to build our houses, etc., but we also need areas that are set aside. And voices like Aldo Leopold worked in the U.S. Forest Service, particularly in the southwestern United States. Bob Marshall began to come together to say, we need more wilderness. We need areas that are not simply for their natural resources, but we need areas that are set aside for the sorts of reasons that we had up there before. So you have a movement, particularly within the Forest Service, to designate certain areas where there is minimal management and where they are designated as wilderness areas. That begins to gather steam. The first sort of area that was set aside and called a wilderness was the Gila Wilderness Area in New Mexico, an area, again, where Aldo Leopold had worked when he was with the Forest Service from there. But all of this really culminates in 1964 with the Wilderness Act. Sort of complex negotiations and trading back and forth, but basically the moments came together. It's a fascinating legislative history where people came together to say, yes, we are ready to declare certain areas within our public lands as wilderness areas to be set aside from other parts of our land in a way that ought to be preserved in perpetuity. And it designated huge numbers of acres at that point, including a couple that are likely to be familiar to us, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, for those of you who have Midwest or Minnesota ties, was created in 1964, expanded in 1978 in a very politically controversial way. Lodges were moved out, and people who had claims on that land were removed. You don't find that in very many wilderness designations. And what sort of surrounds us here, the Glacier Peaks Wilderness, was also created in 1964. About 500,000 acres of land that was set aside as wilderness at that time. And we were talking about what it means to be a wilderness. I think it's worth sort of looking to that piece of legislation, which took this idea and really this movement to begin to preserve land, which had its earliest voice, I would say, its most significant early voice in John Muir arguing for preservation. And Muir and Gifford Pinchot had a very famous fight over what ought we to be doing with our public lands, and focus specifically on the Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite, where Muir was arguing we need to preserve this land. It's God's cathedral. We have an obligation to set this aside and not to develop it further. And Pinchot arguing, no, we need to take care of it for the long term, but ultimately it's our duty to make use of that, to make wise use of those resources from here. So let me read you just a little bit. The Wilderness Act of 1964 defines a wilderness in this way. I want to know whether you think this fits your understanding. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man, sorry, not my language, this is the 60s, where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. An area of wilderness is further defined to mean in this act an area of undeveloped federal land retaining its primeval character and influence without permanent improvements or human habitation, which is protected and managed so as to preserve its natural conditions. So it is this area, as a professor of mine used to like to say, where the hand of man never sets foot. And where really we are the visitors, and where it is defined again by the sort of absence of humans in stepping in there at that point. And so there is this notion within the Wilderness Act of defining things based on a character of naturalness. And in practical terms, that was defined very much as an area that was roadless. So naturalness and roadlessness became the two most important features in looking around to say, what areas should we have as wilderness areas? Hence why Iowa doesn't qualify at all. We've got a road every mile on the square for the whole state of Iowa for the most part, laid out by the surveyors very nicely from there. It is, as defined there, it has to be at least 5,000 acres. A controversial thing because it limited significantly the amount of eastern wilderness, although there was then a separate piece of legislation in the 1970s, the Eastern Wilderness Act, which did designate wilderness areas primarily in Maine, New Hampshire, and in Vermont. And they're much smaller and have a different sort of character. I lived in Vermont, and you would go to these wilderness areas that were literally 6,000 acres as opposed to the Glacier Peaks at 570,000 acres. There's a different scale to things, but still sort of defined by that sort of naturalness and roadlessness at that time as ways of getting at it. What's the most visited wilderness area in the United States?
Yellowstone?
Yellowstone National Park has some wilderness within it, but the most, as with some of the other national parks, it tends to be very backcountry, and actually see, oftentimes the national park wilderness areas do not see lots of traffic in there. You know, Rocky Mountain National Park, I used to live right on the edge of Rocky Mountain National Park. You have millions and millions of visitors that come through, and about half the park is designated wilderness, but it gets very low usage, actually, because people don't tend to come into that. People who are coming to Yellowstone don't tend to be wilderness travelers from there.
The Boundary Waters
is the most visited wilderness area in the United States by quite a long shot, actually. You get lots and lots of people that are coming through there, partly because it's unique character. There's not many other places. So you see people, I mean, I meet people that are traveling from other parts of the country to do their canoe trip in the Boundary Waters. So it gets very high usage, and those of you who have been there before know sometimes it's hard to get a permit. Because they are controlling that usage and trying to manage it from there. And to, for some people's point of view, that's really problematic because we ought to be opening things up more from there. What else? A wilderness area then cannot have roads. There is no mechanized transport allowed whatsoever. So there's no motors allowed unless there's specific exception in the legislation. So this has been a big deal in the Boundary Waters. They have allowed motors on a few lakes. They do allow wheeled portages in places from there. But if you rode your bicycle out that trail and crossed past that sign where you enter the wilderness area and somebody saw you, you would be in violation of the law. When I lived up in northern Minnesota, one spring when things melted down and actually the lakes get almost like a huge parking lot, we took our bikes and rode them way down on Seagull Lake and did this big loop around. And the next day, the Forest Service guy came by and said, I saw your tracks out there. I'm not going to charge you, but you're breaking the law. You cannot ride. Even though we were riding on top of the snow, on top of the water, legally you cannot do that. I had a guy in New Mexico tell a story about some crazy person. Crazy people are always going into the wilderness, right? That's, I think, part of the biblical piece of it. Who showed up with a big wheeled dolly and 2 50-pound bags of oats and had nothing else with him. And he was headed into this wilderness area. And they said they stopped him and said, sorry, you can't take any wheels into the wilderness area at all. So he just looked at him and grabbed one on one arm and the other and walked in, and they never saw him again. So who knows what happened. And there's somebody, I can't remember, is it Jim? You cannot have a hang glider in the wilderness. It violates the conditions for mechanized transport.
Well, I think you can have a hang glider if you're in the air. You just can't land.
You can't land.
Or take it off, yeah.
Yep. So it is a specific designation that places lots of limitations on what people can do.
How about overflying the small planes?
Pardon me?
How about overflying the small planes?
Different, as I understand it, some of you may know more, different wilderness areas have some flyover restrictions. The Boundary Waters, for example, restricts some of the flyover that's allowed to happen there, but I think that's more on a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure exactly about the airspace.
With the all-terrain vehicles now, there's legislation trying to get it passed so people can use those vehicles up there.
Yeah, and I think it does require an act of Congress to allow any sort of motorized vehicles in there. And much of this takes place in the areas that are not wilderness but are public lands from there. So we have huge amounts of public lands, but a very small percentage of it is actually designated as wilderness. So for example, in northern Minnesota, Superior National Forest is a little over 3 million acres, and about 1 million acres of that is the Boundary Waters. So there's about two-thirds of it that's outside, but again, they're trying to sort of manage that. I want to shift, and I've spent more time on this than I've intended, onto sort of why should we preserve wilderness? And if we look into the Wilderness Act further from here, you see that there are two clear rationales given both by people at the time for arguing for this, but within the legislation itself. And one of those is preservation. This idea that what we ought to do is we ought to preserve this land in its pristine state. We ought to have some land where humans are not messing things up, where we're not building our big houses, where we're not driving our ATV vehicles, we're not doing anything from there. On the other hand, you have a very clear rationale for recreation, for a certain type of primitive recreation. So it can't be any sort of recreation that I want, but for backpacking, for hiking, for cross-country skiing, for using horses or mules for sort of packing into the backcountry as a way to sort of protect that. Now, many people have pointed out that there is, at least potentially, and in many cases, very real conflicts between these. And they take place at a practical level, that what sometimes is called the conservationist dilemma is that when we go to conserve an area and publicize our conservation of that area, everybody wants to come visit that wilderness as a way to get away from the other people from there. So this idea that we can love an area to death along the way. But there's also a sort of deeper philosophical conflict here, that with the preservation, we are protecting wilderness because of its intrinsic value. Because of its value set apart from our uses, from our need to sort of be there, whereas the recreational value is clearly for humans. It's an instrumental value. It's a value that is something that's good for us rather than good for itself, if you will, from there. And that doesn't mean that they can't sort of coexist along the way, but what I want to ask you is, which of these is the more powerful or more important, or what should be the primary reason for preserving wilderness? Is it to allow us places where I can go out and go backpacking without worrying about having to have somebody on their dirt bike, you know, scooting down the trail past me? Or thinking about it from a water point of view. It's very different to canoe in northern Minnesota. I can remember canoeing on the Colorado River where a group of jet skiers came along and just started doing circles around our canoes for fun as they were going by. It's a very different recreational experience. Is that the primary reason why we should preserve wilderness? Or is it ultimately really something that's not about our use, but about preservation of nature sort of for itself? Which of those, and I'd like you to go back to your group just for a couple of minutes, which of those is the more important or ought to be the primary justification for wilderness in your mind? Go back to your groups just for a couple of minutes to talk through, and then we'll...
Should it be this or that? Well, it depends on what your battery system is.
But it seems like it's just
kind of No, it's a different thing. But I mean, if it's the idea to get away. They wouldn't necessarily just explore. Should not preserve wilderness, or in some cases to say why we should actually get rid of a bunch of the wilderness areas that we have now. And this is not as hot an issue as it was, say, a decade ago, but it still has this way of sort of finding its way to the surface, either in particular cases or the big one that it seems to never go away is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And this idea that ANWR ought to be either become wilderness and set aside, ought to be locked up, as people on both sides like to say, either in a positive way or a negative way, or should be developed for the oil resources that are there. But so let me just try quickly to do this and then open it up for discussion. Critics of wilderness, I think, really do fall into two different categories. On the one hand, you have the practical objection, which is philosophical in some sense, or comes at it in different ways, but ultimately what people are talking about is to say that we should, that you don't lock up natural resources. And when something is designated as wilderness, it basically prohibits the development of any of those other resources that ultimately, going back to the very beginning of our public lands,
and codified in law in 1960 in what was called the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, which sort of laid out to say you can't just cut and run. But the idea is that the primary purpose of those public lands is to develop those resources for timber, for water, for minerals, for recreation, and for, I'm missing one. Somebody help me out?
The arrogance of man.
Pardon me?
The arrogance of man.
For the arrogance of man. It wasn't in the law, although some people would say grazing is the other one that's there, particularly when you think about BLM, although it's grazing on Forest Service land as well. That ultimately, when we declare this wilderness, when we close it off, no more roads, no more logging, no more mining, nothing, we are locking up in perpetuity those natural resources in a way that sort of prohibits use that we might want in the future. But this argument is strongest, I think, from local communities to say that, hey, our economic base, our jobs, our livelihoods are tied up in being able to develop those resources. And we need that to promote jobs, to promote economic growth, et cetera, as we go forward from there. So that is the argument that comes up repeatedly. And it is one that I think has a certain power to it and should not be dismissed out of hand from there. There's this other argument that has been around, which I would describe as a more sort of a conceptual objection to it, that I want to talk about as well. That basically, the idea is that wilderness, in the minds of some people, and I would say most popularly Michael Pollan, some of you may know the writer, written a lot about food, his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and then another one, In Defense of Food, that came out. But an earlier book, which I would recommend to you, called Second Nature, it's subtitled A Gardener's Education, but he writes about wilderness in there. He's critical of the notion of wilderness from there. And then a historian named William Cronin. The idea here is the claim that somehow wilderness reinforces a human nature dualism. That basically it's reinforcing a skewed idea of the relationship between humans and the natural world. Keep in mind that we're defining wilderness really by the absence of humans, by the absence of human influence, by the absence of human presence from there. And the idea is that what comes out of that is a reinforcement of this idea that humans are here and nature is there. And here's our wilderness, set apart from humans. And that ultimately, by focusing on wilderness, and the claim is that environmentalists have tended to idealize wilderness. That's pure nature. That's the good stuff that's out there. It's what we see out around us here. It's not what I see outside my window in Iowa. It's not what we see in the places that we live that is nature. The real nature is wilderness from there. And the idea is that wilderness really reinforces this idea, but ultimately what we need to do is to see that humans are a part of nature. We're not set apart from it. We are fundamentally a part of the natural world, in that what by looking to wilderness as the place that we go to find nature, by going to Holden Village as the place to connect with nature, as opposed to going to my local pond or going somewhere closer to home, I am ultimately reinforcing this sort of separation, and that we need to break that down. And that therefore there is this sort of problematic idea of wilderness that perhaps we need to somehow get beyond from there. Either of those arguments resonate with you?
Yeah. I always thought that the lockup argument was a short-sighted, development-oriented argument, because if humans create the construct that you lock it up and it becomes a critical need in the future, it could always be unlocked. Mm-hmm. And so we're locking it up because at this point in time we see an intrinsic value to the wilderness. But, let's take the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. If the world has not figured out energy and continues to use oil and there's no more oil left, then at that point in time we might need to unlock the Arctic National Wildlife. But if we've unlocked it before that, it just becomes part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so I've never, you know, I mean, I've always thought that that was a rather short-sighted thing, because we're creating a lockup, and we as humans could uncreate that if it really became a critical. But it's not, in my estimation, critical at this point.
It does require, the unlocking would require both houses of Congress and the president to agree to that.
But that's not an impossibility.
Not by any means. It has a higher standard to it at that point.
Yeah. Well, there's something about going to a place that takes your breath away. Uh-huh. You know, and I mean, I don't feel like I could live on that mountain over there, but it's so nice to be able to see it once in a while. I do feel kind of separate from it, but it just does me a lot of good to see it once in a while. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What do people in a more developed, like England, what do they think about the wilderness? And they have a different, maybe they don't have any. What do they value? I mean, they wish they had something?
Some of you may have a sense of this as well. I was in England 20 years ago, and I can sort of speak to it and get to see. And I think, as was said before, there are not designated wilderness areas anywhere in Europe that I'm aware of at all. They are establishing more and more what they're calling biodiversity reserves within the European Union. Yeah.
There's one in Poland.
Okay.
On the boundary of Poland, it was a royal preserve, and you still have several tens of thousands of acres. We were in Iona last year. And I read some historical accounts of what Scotland used to be like a few thousand years ago. And to somebody with an ecological perspective, I mean, it's basically an ecological disaster. You look over these beautiful hills, but you can see, I mean, there used to be forests now, and now it's heavily eroded soil. There's bare rocks. There's sheep grazing everywhere. It has an austere beauty, but it's a sort of a degraded beauty. And I think that's one of the values of wilderness, is that it's like, as Christians, we aspire to be Christ-like, right? We have Jesus Christ as our example. Well, we aspire to live with nature, and by seeing a place like the Glacier Peak Wilderness, it gives us some idea of the world that the Lord created for us, and of its current fallen state. And hopefully it inspires people to say, you know, gee, I'd like my stream in my neighboring village or county to be half as clean as Railroad Creek. It gives us some idea of what could be done. And there's natural resources, the natural ecosystems, the microorganisms in the soil, some of which in Yellowstone are being used for medical research now. The thing is, we know so little about nature, we don't really know what we're destroying yet. And when we develop these oil fields, I mean, we could have developed the Anwar 20, 30 years ago when the world price of oil was about $10 a barrel. But someday, if we have to develop it, and the price of oil is $200 or $300 a barrel, it may be a greater benefit to us. And we know it'll be developed in a much more ecologically improved way than it would have been back 70s. So to me, there's a great argument to be made just to preserve these, because we are so woefully ignorant. We don't know what we're losing when we clear cut the forest, when we tear up the streams.
Does seeing sort of this hillside help us when we go back to the areas where we live and we need to sort of work with the land? Does it help us to sort of be better stewards of that land? Or I think part of the argument that's here is by saying, hey, this is where nature is and we're preserving it, and people are disconnected from the way that they actually may be impacting the land when they're back home again.
I think that's a weak argument.
Why?
I don't think there's a disconnect. Oh, here's nature and here's my home, I think. You know, even those of us who are gardeners kind of aspire to something more than just grass in our house.
Well, it's how many wilderness advocates are actually gardeners as well?
Oh, yeah.
I can see why Pollock would come up with that, because it's the same as his whole theory disconnected with the food supply, which is definitely true. But I guess as a wilderness advocate, I don't feel
a disconnect between those two. As a, and I'm also a farmer, so I don't feel a disconnect between those two things. But I can see where he would come up with that.
It is interesting. As somebody who spent a lot of time in the wilderness and is very interested in sustainable agriculture and gardening, etc., those communities of people have almost no overlap between them. Folks who are interested in sort of in saying, how do we work with the land in a way that helps to prevent soil erosion, etc., and those who are interested in backpacking in the wilderness and preserving wilderness, they're different groups, they're different individuals, and there tends to be very little sort of overlap between those, which I actually think supports the argument here to say that that's sort of the way it works. When you go to a trailhead, lots of places, you're seeing big SUVs. If you see those people when they are back in their lives again, they aren't necessarily sort of modeling the sorts of behaviors that you would think of as being stewards of God's creation.
Maybe you have studied this. I mean, I haven't, but just taking one example, like the spotted owl thing out here some years ago, as you remember. And but going back to this, I've always had the impression that those people who live not in the wilderness but closest to the land, like the western moving frontier, are least likely to be sympathetic to these environmental concerns, whereas the people who live in big cities and are well educated and think about this stuff a lot are somewhat more. And so it raises the and the reason, of course, is very obvious. Where my son lives, just whole timber industries went devastated, and they've been economically depressed ever since. So the big question is whether those who, for all of us, if we want to advocate this kind of environmentalism, whether we're willing to pay the price on our own piece of property or in our own lifestyles, or is that only an ideal which we will legislate for Anwar or some other remote place as long as we don't have to pay the price, personally?
And that, I mean, that is the argument, I think, which is to say that the ultimate need is for each of us to understand our connections to nature and the ways in which we can be good stewards in our daily lives wherever we are. And that wilderness, in some sense, is a distraction from that rather than being something that sort of adds to it. A couple more comments and we need to wrap up. So.
Yeah. I just would say that the pollen argument seems to also assume that if you get rid of these things, and humans will sort of wake up and realize what they need to do and like make good decisions. And I'm just not convinced that, given that, you know, that we'll do the right thing and come to see ourselves as interconnected, and wow, we'll really start respecting things. I'm just not convinced that humans are that intelligent. And the gentleman over there was talking about God's creation and stuff. It's a little bit to me like, well, we all pretend to, I mean, you know, a lot of us say that we're Christians, but every Sunday it's still great to go to church, right? And like to be in this intense environment where you're reminded of these things. And so to me, that's what coming to a national wilderness area is like. It's that sort of intense reminder of this thing that you care about, so that when you go back out to do other things, hopefully you carry it with you, but it's good to have that reminder there so that you can go out and be a better steward, I guess.
This business of knowing when we can unlock locked up land is a very tricky thing in my mind, because that has to, who's going to determine when all of a sudden we need to have to unlock it? And doesn't the greed factor kick in? And I think we can hope that stewardship would be in a better place, use of land and that sort of thing. But what proof do we have that we're going to be in a better spot at the point we have to unlock?
It's a good question. I don't know what
the answer is. And I think pertinent to that, I heard a discussion on public radio just within the last couple of months that said, as the demographics in the United States shift, and within 10 years or less, the majority of the population will be of color instead of our background, more or less, and that there isn't so, and it was a discussion about wilderness, and it was And it said basically that there isn't an ethic, a wilderness ethic, amongst a lot of the immigrant populations that have come to the United States. And I'm by no means anti-immigration. I'm just saying as we want to protect wilderness, somehow we have to sort of make this argument or make these issues public so that we get buy-in from a more diverse group of individuals in this country, or that whole unlocking process might take place sooner than we would like.
We need to wrap up from here, but who did you want to comment on that?
Just very quickly.
Yeah.
That may be a reflection of the difference, it says, in access to wealth and power among the different groups. My wife, for example, when we met, noticed that I didn't like to go to restaurants and have candlelight dinners. Mm-hmm. I felt very uncomfortable for a reason that I couldn't articulate. I couldn't really figure it out until, you know, after a while of thinking, I realized that I didn't like darkness, you know, candlelight, because it was associated with poverty, with my childhood, you know, in rural Mexico, and I just, it was bothersome to me. And similarly, you know, nature for many people in many parts of the world. I would say, wilderness or you know the natural environment for 60 to 80% of the population of the world means hostility, a hostile environment. It means diseases. It means you know vulnerability. It means disasters. And that's what weather is. And so in actually enjoying the wilderness the way people do it here is kind of a luxury that you can afford when you have, you know, when you have a certain control over nature.
There's a, we'll sort of wrap it up here so that those of you who want to stay for the next session or whatever, but there's a whole nother really fascinating criticism of wilderness, that basically it is an elitist, ethnocentric concept that that doesn't have application, and if anything, it actually has, it can be incredibly harmful when applied in other places, because it involves displacing people that live on the land in order to try to create these areas. Thank you so much for your comments and engagement and great discussion.
Thank you.